Hi, this is Tish Perlman. Welcome to the broadcast of our live event recorded at Ithaca's Kitchen Theater. I hope you enjoy this special one-hour show. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us tonight. Rachel Lampert is a playwright, director, and choreographer now in her 14th year as artistic director of Ithaca's Kitchen Theater Company. She is a graduate of New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, and her theater career spans four decades, beginning as a dancer in the Lincoln Center Broadway revival of West Side Story. Throughout the late 1970s and 1980s, she toured with her own dance company, Rachel Lampert and Dancers, and she has written dozens of plays for the Kitchen Theater Company, including the main stage musicals Bed, No Breakfast, Comfort Food, Tony and the Soprano, and The Delightful Precious Nonsense. Her main stage non-musicals include The Trial, The Lampert Variations, and a much-loved work, The Soup Comes Last. She received a 2004 Syracuse Area Live Theater Award for Best Actress for her performance in The Soup Comes Last, and has been nominated twice for a Syracuse Area Live Theater Best Director Award. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
And Margaret Perry is a director based in New York City. She received her MFA in directing from Southern Methodist University, and she has directed many off-Broadway productions, including the critically acclaimed Clean Alternatives by Brian Dykstra, which won the Fringe Fest Award at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. Other New York credits include Welcome to Arroyo's at the Hip Hop Theater Festival and Spill the Wine and Competing Narratives at the New York City Gay Fest. Perry is also well known here at the Kitchen Theater Company for her direction of the popular and acclaimed Rachel Lampert works Precious Nonsense, Tony and the Soprano, and The Soup Comes Last. Perry is an artistic fellow at the Lark Play Development Center, where she has worked with a variety of writers developing new plays. And welcome.
Thanks.
I want to begin with you, Rachel. You started your career as a dancer and a choreographer. What drew you to dance originally?
My Aunt May was in the Yiddish theater, and she was also, she performed in several Broadway musicals. She was a character actress. And for some reason, I was her favorite relative, I think. And she took me when I was five to see the then Sadler Wells Ballet, which is now the Royal Ballet, and I saw Margot Fonteyn dance at the old Metropolitan Opera House, and I saw her dance. She was dancing the Swan Queen, and I said, that's what I want to be. And it was pretty much from that point on that that is what I wanted to be.
And you are the Swan Queen.
Oh, yes, I am.
but you went on to found, you know, you founded a dance company. And tell us about touring for 15 years as a dancer.
Well, I continued dancing. I had wanted to be a ballet dancer. That just sort of wasn't in the cards. I found modern dance when I went to college. I went first to Mount Holyoke College, and there was a wonderful modern dance teacher who was in the original Graham Company, and she encouraged me to do modern dance. And then I left to go to Tisch, which was then not even called Tisch. It was called School of the Arts. Jean Erdman was my mentor. She was an amazing person, encouraged me to be a choreographer. I formed a dance company in 1975. And from 1975 pretty much to about straight through to 1992, I would say, would be the ebbing years of the dance company. Steve Nunley, who works here at the Kitchen, was with me for a good deal of that.
Mm-hmm.
30 weeks a year on the road, mostly seeing America. In Europe, too, and but mostly America, trapped in the Midwest for long periods of time. when I die and they take your brains apart, which I'm quite sure by the time I do, they'll be able to just suck all the knowledge out. They'll wonder why she knows where there's the only good cup of coffee in Neely, Nebraska. And that will be because
she spent a lot of time there, yeah. Well, what about you, Margaret? What captured your imagination about becoming a director?
Wow, that's a great question. I think about this often. I can only say that when I had no idea what directing was, but I was fascinated with theater. And I went to the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, and they had a very small theater department. And I had signed up for a philosophy course my freshman year, and my brother ran into me walking out of registration and said, turn around and get whatever class you can. Don't take that teacher. It's awful. You don't want it. So I went back into the room. It was late in the day in registration. There was lines everywhere, and I looked over at the theater table, and there was no line. So I walked over.
Is that considered inspiration?
This is inspiration, yeah. That's really inspiration, right? No line. So I went over, and my to-be mentor is sitting in front of me, and I said, you know, I'd like to take a theater class. And this is strange, because there's always way too many women in acting classes, mm-hmm. but they needed one more woman in the basic acting class. So I got in, and I showed up at the class, and this crazy tall acting teacher was rolling around on the floor, and I thought, that is the craziest thing I've ever seen. I had no idea what to, I mean, I had no experience with theater. My parents had taken me to the theater a lot as a kid, and I just fell in love with it. And by my junior year, I was in Edward Bond's The Sea doing the lead, and I'm a terrible actor, but I did all the leads at Holy Cross when I was there. I mean, they wouldn't say I was terrible, but trust me, it would not have been a good career choice. But my character was directing 8 of the townspeople in a production of Orpheus and Eurydice and playing the ukulele. And so it's a great play. And the director, who was the chairman of the theater department, said, would you improv this scene? And I proceeded to get so into the improv, I staged the entire scene.
So that's where that came out.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and he came up to me at the end of rehearsal and he said, you're taking my directing class. And I said, I don't even know what that is. He said, you're taking my directing class. And then my senior year, before my senior year, he sent me to University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. They had a director's colloquium where professors in theater would come every summer, and they would, I think it was 2 weeks, and you would learn from Joanne Acolytis, Mark Lamos, John Jory, some great theater directors. And they sent me there and said, you're to learn everything you can learn because you are going to be directing a main stage show for the college. And they gave me that opportunity, which they had never done. And
wow.
So that got me into grad school. And I had the bug.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, I want to talk to you too, Rachel, so you quit dance and you quit choreography and you begin writing plays. Was there some kind of a bug in you to start writing and using dialogue instead of just choreographing dance?
Well, actually, it didn't quite happen that way because uh-huh. I always, even when I started choreographing, I used words. And I was always really interested in the mix of words mm-hmm. and movement. And I used to do dances that would have a few words. And then I did dances that would have longer amounts of words. And then I started calling them dance plays. And so I've been writing for most of my adult life mm-hmm. in my work. And it shifted to being a more playwriting when I stopped touring with my dance company and shifted more towards writing. But for a long time, I used to make a lot of my living doing industrial shows for corporations where I did a lot of writing about, like...
Industrial shows for corporations?
It's a dirty secret.
I've done them, too.
It's a dirty secret, you know. But
they're quite lucrative.
They're very,
I would assume that's
they're
why.
Really lucrative. Yeah, Margaret and I share this so that she has an entire sort of commercial career, too. And so I did a lot of writing, which was really good because that's where you write something that, you know, this year we're going to, you know, this is the new glass. Last year we didn't have these little dots on it, so it's new and improved. And now we're going to have to, we can never say, like, last year's glass wasn't any good. We just have to say how much better it is now. So it is the positive choice. And then you write something that you think is absolutely wonderful, you know, a great idea, and then some executive comes in and says, well, that's not really what we want. And it's not like writing a play where you, with an artistic director, might say, well, what about this character? I don't quite believe it. You go, oh, not what you wanted. Fine, be back tomorrow or be back in 3 hours and how about this? So it's a sort of...
It sounds like a good exercise.
It thickens your skin.
You know, to develop a character.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. If anybody says, like, I don't like that, that's going fine. You know, Margaret has directed some of my plays, and she'll say, you know, I'm not sure this is working, and she's very kind. She comes very quietly over, tiptoe, Rachel, I had this little idea, perhaps we could get rid of this, you know, and I'm like, what? What? Okay, fine. Right. Sometimes she has to stop me. Don't get rid of it. Let me fix it. I'll fix it with the actors, you know.
Well, you're based in New York, and you obviously live here, Rachel. How did you guys meet and begin your collaboration? It has to be an interesting story, I'll bet.
We could both tell our own version of it. I'll start with mine, and you
can
go.
All right. I was directing Clean Alternatives by Brian Dykstra at 59 E59 Theaters in New York, innocently watching the show one night, and this woman comes up to me, and she says, "I want this play in my theater." And I went, "Sure you do," because I've heard that 100 times. And I it was actually delightful meeting her, because she was really effusive, and it's really nice when an artistic director from a theater company, so I'm being flip, but it was really actually, I left feeling very, very good that night, but thinking, knowing nothing was going to come of it. Uh-huh. And at 11 a.m. the next morning, there was an offer to do the show in the theater. Now, I'm telling you, this kind of thing takes 3 years normally.
I can
believe
it, yeah.
So the next day, not only we're interested, could you send me the script, blah, blah, blah. It was an out and out, we want this show. And I said, "Brian, what do you want to do about this?" He said, "Say yes. That's crazy. We have to encourage that kind of behavior in this country." And we didn't, at the time, we had just done the first round of that play, and we were intending to take it to the Edinburgh Festival. And so that to take it to the Edinburgh Festival, you have to actually, you only can do 90 minutes.
Oh.
And the play was about 2 hours. So we had to cut a half hour out of the play. And we cut a lot of humor out of it and a lot of the guts out of it, but we cut it down. And that exercise really helped when, by the time we got back to the kitchen with the show, and after we won a Fringe First, then we really got to look at the show again. And we put some of it back, but not all of it. Hmm. And the first day of rehearsal, Rachel said, "You know, I think you say this in every..."
She started to learn
show.
Your habits.
Which, no, it's one of the, and now I do. I've taken it on myself, is that she says that we continue working on a play all the way through the process. That opening night is not the end of the work, mm-hmm. that we continue to work on it. And what was great about that is we've been doing this play for almost a year with this cast. And not the entire cast, but many of the players. And but we did continue to work on it, and we developed it even more here, and we just ended up having a wonderful experience.
Yeah, it helped tighten it up.
Yeah.
So tell us how you met Margaret. What was your what's your story?
My husband David and I had gone to New York for the weekend, and we had seen, I think we saw a title of show of my friend Larry Presgrove's show, and we saw another show, and it was like Sunday evening, and we had time to see a show, and so we started walking uptown, and I saw, and I buy my plays by the number of actors, so I'm looking in, you know, okay, three actors, it's about the environment, oh, let's go try and see that. So we walked up to 59th Street and said, if there are tickets, we'll go in. We got the last two tickets, we sat right in the front row, we're the last people there, lights went out, the first scene happened. Brian and Mark Boyette come on stage. I mean, I never saw them before. And the two of us started laughing like in the first 20 seconds of the play. And I turned to David and I said, "This is great." And he said, "Yes." And I mean, David is not the easiest laugh, you know, so he was really enjoying it. And it kept going on and on and on. So at the intermission, I saw this woman running around, kind of like Wile E. Coyote, you know. No, it's the road runner, like this, you know. And I said, "That must be the producer." So I looked around, and there was somebody in the audience I knew, and I said, "Do you know who that is?" And she said, "Yeah, that's Margaret Perry. She's the director." I said, "Couldn't you introduce me?" So at the end of the show, she introduced me, and I said exactly what I said. "This is lovely and wonderful, and I'd really like to have it." And we had a spot in the season that I hadn't done yet, and it seemed perfect. And then, of course, I had to go, you know, count the shekels. And that's why I could call her up at 11 o'clock in the morning and say, "Hey, how about this?"
That must have been amazing.
And what was really great was that they were going to Edinburgh, and that when they, so I got to see the play before they went to Edinburgh and made all the changes. And there was a new actor in it, which was nice to see how that changed. And then I think what was really the best thing was that the kitchen could give it a rehearsal period. So we didn't just like take the play from Edinburgh and then just put it into the kitchen.
Yeah.
Brian got to work on it again with an artistic director, and that was really where we sort of forged our relationship. You know, it's an interesting relationship, artistic director, because the director has their ideas about the play, and then the artistic director brings to that his or her ideas about the play, but also his or her knowledge of the audience in front of which this play is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that oftentimes directors forget is that a play happens in a very specific theater on a very specific night in a very specific community. And it's really easy to just think it's this my play that I'm directing.
Right, right, right.
And then the artistic director, and I think over the years I've really now do understand most of the time what it is our audience is looking for, and sometimes it's a little bit different than what the director is looking for, mm-hmm. that the first time we worked, we really were able to talk about how you might do, the play might be different in the New York production than in the Ithaca production.
Exactly, yeah.
And sometimes it's because the Ithaca audience is so discerning. I mean, really discerning.
This is a hard crowd in this town. It's much more sophisticated than
in many ways.
Think, yeah.
In many ways, it's more, and because in New York there's a larger demographic, so you'll have the really sophisticated folks that come here and see a lot of theater and are big thinkers,
mm-hmm.
and but you also have a lot of people just like go to the theater,
just want to be in
which is a different thing, and so that forged our relationship.
Yeah, and you know, Margaret, I want to ask you this too. I mean, you work in New York City, big place. How is it to have a home here at the Kitchen Theater? Has that changed you as a director? Changed you as a creative person?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's very different. I wanted to just say that I find this audience here, you say it's a tough audience, and it is because it's the smartest audience I've ever played for, but the most generous in terms of, maybe not generous is not the right word, but the laughter that comes from really smart stuff. I mean, we played Clean Alternatives for a long time and came up here and people got jokes they never got in the UK or
really?
In New York City. And we actually had the reverse experience because we did Brian's play, A Play on Words, here, and then Elizabeth Kleinhans invited it to be a part of America's Off-Broadway back at 59 East 59. And so that play was fully, you know, had just come off a 4-week run here, so it was really warmed up and ready to go. And took it back to New York, and the set of laughs in New York were completely different than the set of laughs it got here.
That's amazing.
So,
so
yeah.
has this helped you develop as a creative person, as a director, to have a safe place like this small theater is kind of a second home?
Unquestionably. I mean, it's in two major ways. In one, I've had the opportunity to direct plays that I would not probably get the opportunity to direct this season. Doing Private Lives.
Mm.
You have to be famous, old, and male to direct that play. No one lets you do that, let alone with the funky casting we had, or some people would claim we had. But that was, you know, scary and incredibly exciting, and I felt incredibly comfortable doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Pinter's Old Times, which I directed a couple of years ago, which is another one that you don't really get the opportunity to direct, certainly not in New York.
Yeah.
And then just the work on new plays, and just working on so many. I mean, I've directed, I think, 17 shows here since I met Rachel in February of 2006.
That is a lot of work.
Yeah.
Wow.
Between main stage shows, Kitchen Sink, and
Counterculture
shows, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I worked with her on Soup Comes Last, and so just being able to do that much work is, you learn something on every show. Every show has a different set of, it's a different kind of puzzle to crack.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's, you learn things as you go, but it's great to be able to do that.
Yeah, I'll bet it is. Now, I want to talk about developing a play, and since you guys both worked on The Soup Comes Last, tell us how that begins and ends and how you develop a play like that. Can you talk about that?
Well, Margaret kind of came in, I would say, third stage development of the play, because
mm-hmm.
the early stage development of the play, the writing of the play, Wendy Dan was working on it with me, and she helped to sculpt its first version of it. Then I took it to New York, and another director, Karen Eisenberg, worked on it with me, and we changed a lot of things. And then when I wanted to do it again here, I had watched Margaret work with other actors, and I really admired the way she worked with them, and I wanted a shot at that. I wanted that sort of special care and feeding that she gives to actors, and I wanted her eye on it. So when she did the third go-around, we made it start like with the curtain speech. I mean, we actually realized what the other two directors had wanted it to be but never could quite get it. And it has a little bit to do with who I am as an actor, mm-hmm. which is not someone with an MFA in acting, but a person who's used to telling stories and had mm-hmm. always told stories. So it started with me coming out and doing the curtain speech, you know, just good evening, I'm Rachel Lampert, I'm here to, in the Kitchen Theater, that's where I'm most comfortable, you know, and the other two were trying very hard for it to say, yeah, Rachel, you should just tell the story like you do when you have everybody over for dinner and you tell a story. Mm-hmm. And of course, because it was theatrical, there was always... All the other characters were fine except the Rachel character. It's like we talk about the Rachel character, you know. The other characters are fine. The Chinese characters are fine. The woman I went to China with, Joanne, was fine. The Rachel character, how do you find the relaxation to do who you really are? It's very hard. In any one-person play, you find that the character of the playwright is really hard. And Margaret really worked on that with me, and we changed some things, we took out a scene.
Tell them a little bit about what the story is about. You went to China.
I went to China in 1997 to do West Side Story with an all Chinese cast, and I went with another woman who was the director, and then I wrote a play about it. And she and I had our own conflicts about how we deal in foreign countries and how we deal with cross cultural things. I just immediately became very Chinese, and I just said, okay, this is how it is. And she really tried to push it to be more with an American sensibility, which we got a lot of resistance to, but she seemed to not be able to actually experience that or hear it. She refused to hear it. And so there was a lot of push-pull, and there was a lot of a lot of cultural misunderstandings. Ultimately, it was, for me, a life-changing experience and actually allowed me to feel comfortable saying yes to taking over the Kitchen Theater as the artistic director, because I thought, oh, the Kitchen Theater at the time was like one bad show away from closing its doors. And I'd just done West Side Story in China with people who'd spoke no English, so, hey, I can run the Kitchen Theater. That's like, boom, that's nothing compared to that. So,
I mean, what kind of dynamic do you have as a director when somebody's developing a play? I mean, do you actually get a say in writing it, or...?
Well, yeah, it depends on the writer, really, and it depends.
In regard to this one,
this is an interesting. Mm-hmm. I came in late in the development, so I wasn't really looking at the writing as much as Rachel as an actor performing it. But we did discover some writing changes that we wanted by working on the acting. There are many different things you do. One, I like to first just look at the play as a director, and if I have the play and I know that I'm doing a production of it, sometimes the changes come out in rehearsal, and you want to wait to start really getting it on its feet. If the writer's really confident with it, and you say, well, I don't know, is this a writing problem, an acting problem, or a directing problem? Mm-hmm. And you constantly try to shift and figure out where the problem is, and it's like whack-a-mole. One will pop up, the other will come out, and you kind of keep going. So I love to problem solve, and so I really try to trust the play first. But there are plays that I get very early on in development. Sometimes it's just an idea, or I do dramaturgy for not a side job, it's definitely part of my job, but I do have a lot of clients that are playwrights. And actually one of my clients who's a playwright came to me very early on, and about a year into the process we started co-writing the play. So I've done that too. I don't ever want to do that again. I'm not a writer. I learned that doing that. But but what it did do is it really helped me fine-tune my dramaturgical skills. But I'm really good at reading plays and knowing what's up with them. When I respond to writers, I really try to respond with words like, this is what I'm getting from this, and this is how I feel when I read this, rather than I wish it was this way, or you know, I would like to see a play that included X rather than X because this is what I'd like to do, because I don't think that's as helpful to the writer process. And it depends on the writer, though, because some writers are, you know, I have a writer that I love named Philip Gerson, who's worked in Hollywood, and you could go to him and say anything, and he's got a hard backbone. I have other writers that I work with that you make a suggestion to them, and they'll just change it because you said so, and you don't want that.
Yeah,
so you have to be really careful, and it really depends on who they
Which
are.
Which way is she?
You start to even walk close to the problem. She goes, no, tell me, what is it? It's gonna be, and she's got the pen out, you know? She's got a really strong backbone with that. You know, when we worked on Tony and the Soprano, there was one scene that was just, I didn't quite buy it. I didn't quite, the event in the scene wasn't clear to me, and it was late at night. We went home, we were to her apartment, and we were working on it, and she kind of just got the pen out and scribble, scrabble, and then suddenly we had a great scene. It happened like that.
Wow.
But that's because she'd seen a production of the play before. She'd experienced it, and she must have also felt it. Because she's not going to change it if she doesn't also feel it, too.
But Margaret does have a very good way of working with playwrights, and, and particularly I like watching how she does it, because I am a much more slash and burn kind of person. So, you know, but mostly because I can take it. So I learned from her how to be a little bit more careful with playwrights, because some people you can shut them down,
with
an actor.
Anybody in the
You have to, as a director, be careful with actors to just not be give too much information, because then they have you in their head rather than themselves in their head. And so if you say, you know, make sure you put that glass down carefully. Every time they get to that, they hear it, make sure you put that glass down carefully, and they can't get out of it. And the writer is the same way. They get in their heads. They can't go on. Mm-hmm. So she's very good with that, and I wish I was as gentle as you.
Well, I think it just comes from having... I work at the Lark Play Development Center a lot, and I've worked with a lot of different writers, and I've actually had the experience of giving somebody writer's block.
Really?
Yes.
And they told you that?
Yes. A couple of times it's happened. It's because you say something too specific too early in their process.
Uh-huh.
And that's something you go, oh, God. You know, and you learn it later, but, you know, I just don't. But then you have to really, it's hard, because you have to read their behavior and understand. Some writers want you to go in there and say, this is exactly what I'm feeling.
And I talked to so many writers who said they have to get that censor off their shoulders anyway, just to even start the process.
Yeah.
So if you do shut somebody down while they're in the beginnings of it, I'm sure it's devastating.
Yeah, it's much easier later on when things are, you know, once they've had a few readings and maybe a workshop of something, and they've had, you know, I always say, listen to the echoes when you have... 3 or 4 times you've seen something in front of an audience, whether it's a reading or a workshop or whatever, and random people are coming up to you and kind of saying the same thing, then you start to listen to those patterns. Any one person's opinion, no matter who they are, you shouldn't listen to it. You know, even if it's somebody that's promising to produce your play, if you do something, you know, you need to be, what is it that I want to do? What is it that I want to say? But if you're hearing it from 10 different people, 5 different people, you start to perk up and say, maybe I do have a problem.
I want to ask you guys this, too, because you obviously are an actor part of the time, and you obviously aren't. Is that a detriment to a director, artistic director? Is it helpful, the fact that you have been an actor, and is it a hindrance that you aren't, and say that you aren't good at it, to direct people?
Well, I went through acting training. I have an MFA in directing, and in that process, you have to go through the graduate acting training. So I went through... other people that were getting their MFAs, I was right next to them.
Okay.
I had to play Mary Stewart in a corset. And I had a famous moment where I walked on stage and said, "Where's Lord Morton?" And the whole place went up because of my incredible British dialect.
Where's Lord Morton?
Where's Lord Morton? You know, she's really running the country. And I was trying to be grounded, and I didn't realize my hard R's, you know, were coming through.
But so you understand the dynamics of acting.
It's very important for a director to understand that, and that's why they make you go through that training. Directors that don't have that experience, I think, work with actors in a much different way. And but I actually have learned the most about working with actors through listening to actors complain about directors.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And that's actually, if you catalog everything you hear, they hate when they do that. I heard once from an actor who I really respect, never say no to the first 3 choices an actor makes, even if you hate them. And you know you're never going to have it, you do a lot of shutting up in the beginning of the rehearsal period and just let them flow.
Uh-huh.
You know. And I didn't have that experience as an actor because I never really was doing a lot of stage work where I would know that. But I only know that from hearing that from other actors and then from watching Oh, yeah, I actually, recently I squelched a choice in an actor early on, and I watched it haunted me weeks later. I wish I had done that. So you relearn the lessons.
What about your experience as an actor and director?
Well, I think that if you you do need to get out of the actor's way, and if you really are lucky in how you've cast a show, which, I mean, is a lot of things, then, mm-hmm. then and the actors are playful, if you can create a playful environment, then it's really great. And I know that for me, when I do act in a play, I'm always reminded at how difficult it is for actors. Mm-hmm. And that one has to be really sensitive to where they are, how they're thinking, and the fact that they are ultimately going to be out there completely naked in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. So keeping the atmosphere in the room playful, keeping the atmosphere in a way that people feel like, you know, they're trusted and they can give their ideas and they're not going to get shut down is really critical. I mean, I had an experience with a director who I had written my first solo show, who directed it and pretty much acted out every line for me. I mean, in some way, because he didn't trust me as an actor.
That cannot be helpful.
And I remember the first performance of it, it was commissioned by a theater in St. Louis, and I did it in Virginia first. And I got through it the first night. And he had given me 1,000 notes. I had done 800 of them, but I hadn't done the last 200.
Oh,
and he's a director who has quite a reputation in New York. And he came into my dressing room. It was the first time I was ever in a dressing room all by myself at the end of a performance, which was really a new experience. And I came down there and I just started weeping because I was just so glad it was over. I had done it in front of an audience. I had done 800 of the 1,000 things that he had told me. And he came into the dressing room and he opened the door and he said, "Well, if you're not going to be listening to the things that I say, perhaps you don't really need a director."
Oh,
and it was
God.
Such a slap. And I was so shocked at being talked to that way when I expected him to come in there and say, "Oh, wow, you did it," you know, and he didn't. And that was pretty early on in my life, and so I would never do that to anybody else because
yeah.
that's, you know, even when an actor is not doing what you want them to do, you still have to be on their side.
Yeah.
There's no way. I mean, the other choice is to get rid of the actor. You could fire an actor.
Yeah.
But you can't. It's a dialogue.
Oh, I would think that would
it's
cause
a, total
a lot
dialogue.
Of damage to some souls, you know? I mean, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
God.
Well, there's a saying, you can tell me what to do or how to do it, but you can't tell me both. And that is a rule that I live by as a director. If I've told you to cross right on that line and pick up that the glass and drink water there, I can tell you to do that because that's what I want you to do, but I can't tell you how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I can tell you what I want you to play on that line, but I can't tell you how to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what qualities do you value in actors now that you've been in the business for quite a while?
Intelligence, playfulness, curiosity, a willingness to just try anything. I mean, that's the thing, is that sometimes there's a lot of conversation in the rehearsal process, and some of that conversation is really critical because you have to get to the psychological life of the actor, of the character. You have to figure out what's going on in the scene. If you're working on a new play, there's like a whole other level of things going on.
Oh, yeah.
Because some things might not be truthful to the character that are maybe the playwright's problem. But you have to really find people who don't have to defend any choice. And that happens when they feel comfortable and loved and in the room and okay. And so therefore, any choice can happen. And then if you say, you know, like, "I don't know why, but I was thinking that somehow, sometime in the scene, somehow you guys get on the floor and, I don't know, roll around and maybe it ends over there," and, you know, and they're in period costumes, let's say. And then, you know, and so they might be that the actor might turn around and say, "Oh, but we're in period costumes. How could we possibly do that?" And then you have a choice. You could, like, back off and say, "Okay." Or you could say, "Well, I don't know. Why don't we just try it?" And then an actor might say, "But it doesn't make any sense." And at that point, you're starting to have an argument with them about it. It's not worth it, I don't think, at that point. But most, when you're working with actors who are playful, They'll go like, oh, okay, fine. Because as soon as it's done, we'll all know if it's right or wrong. I mean, that's the wonderful thing. You get these moments where somebody tells you, you've always done it over here. She did this to me. She told me, and certainly I did it to her and Brian in a play once. You know, she said to me, in Soup Comes Last, she said, I was always doing this as a phone call. She said, that makes no sense. That's ridiculous. You know, that just makes no sense. Just try it another way. And we didn't even have to have a conversation about it. You know, just try it, because then we would know. Because as soon as we did it, we was like, oh, yeah, that's the way that should be. So, but people are very vulnerable, and how you get an actor to that place where they feel so comfortable that they're not going to shut down or get worried. Because, like, you're in this private room. I've never understood it. You know, like, I never understood why an actor would... would do that, because
this, yeah.
You're in a private room. Everybody in that room is trying to make this play happen. So why wouldn't we all just, like, if the director said, what if we, like, we're all running in place during this time? I don't know what, you know, something like that. Let's just try it. You know, who knows? You know, we're doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but we're going to be running in place. I don't know. It might, something might happen.
I would question that.
But... it's just so, it's great when people try something like that, because as soon as you do it, you go, oh, no, not that. You know,
actors have to be brave. Are there special qualities in certain actors that you value more so than others?
Yes. We were just talking about this the other day. And my list starts with relaxed.
Mm.
Relaxed and confident. And then the next thing I'm looking for is inventiveness. And then a wicked sense of humor.
Ah.
And relaxed is really on the top of it all, because if they're relaxed and easygoing, like Rachel said, they're probably going to be more open. And I'm finding that confidence is something that as I'm getting older and more experienced, I find it something I'm really, really wanting more of, because my patience also is getting less. You know, I try to have a lot of patience, but at some point I'm like, come on, recognize how fabulous you are. You're amazing. I mean, there's so many actors that you know how talented they are, and you can see it and you can feel it, and you're just going, come on, take the extra step.
Yeah.
And it comes from their own sense of personal confidence that they just don't have it quite yet. And then sometimes you get really lucky, and over a run of a show, you watch that grow, and that can be really wonderful.
Yeah, I want to ask you guys this, too. You often hear when you especially in film, you see a performance by somebody who you know is a competent actor, and somebody will say, but they needed a better director. Can a director make up for an actor's weaknesses and help them if they're not giving a good performance? Is that possible? Because you do hear that often. She needed a stronger director.
I know. Who's taking this one?
Go ahead, Rachel.
I think it's really hard to know, for a lot of audiences to know, like, was that the actor or the director's choice?
Right, right.
It's really difficult. But if you're, you know, sometimes the director's choice might be, like, some stylization of something, and then you can say, well, boy, that didn't work. I mean, that would be, let's do, you know.
Have Martha march around the room.
Doing
yeah.
Martha running in place, you know. So, so then you can tell. But sometimes a director, when they insist on something, and the actor hasn't bought into it, you can see the bad concept or the bad idea.
Uh-huh.
But it's very hard to discern that. I mean, oftentimes I'll come away from a play and I'll say, I didn't really like this production, but I think if we did it at the kitchen, we could still do the play, and because I think it was the director's ideas here. But I think a really good director can help an actor who's lost, can help an actor do a, you know, change direction, can do things that we always talk about, the positive choice, that, you know, you can take an actor who's a really good actor and just say, make the positive choice on that, and that will change everything about what they're doing in the play.
Yeah.
I think you can have a tremendous influence on it, but it's very hard to tell. I mean, I think I can tell, like, oh, that the director, this is a director, this
the
is not that actor,
yeah.
Because it's, you know, they wouldn't be out to lunch like this, but, you know, I've
What about you, Margaret? Do you think you can help an actor with weaknesses and just by your advice and so on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I love actors. I love actors so much, I can't even begin to tell you how much I love actors. And first of all, you try to cast people that don't have weaknesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you might find in a play you hit a bump or something that they just don't understand, that doesn't feel right for them, and then you can really help. But I've also done a fair amount of teaching acting, and so I know, you know, there are things you can do to help a less experienced actor, or if you have characters, and so you need actors that are, say, under 30, that have a lot less experience on stage, then you can really help them, because the director is really in charge of the tone of the show, the psychological, what the psychological stakes are, and how the characters map through it, the journey, you know, we use the word journey a lot, how they journey through it. And a director, given their taste, can take a drama and grind it down and make it, or find the lightness in it. And that's when we talk about positive choices. It's important. I mean, I'm doing a play that just opened last week in New York by Israela Margalit called First Prize. And it's about the story of a young concert pianist. And my women in the show, we joke because they call themselves bitter and sarcastic. And they're just two women that don't really understand the positive choice. But the characters, particularly that the young pianist is playing, Lori Prince is playing the part, and she's a wonderful actress, but she doesn't tend to make positive choices. And there was this wonderful scene in which she has to basically go up to a bartender and celebrate the fact that she's just come off her first concert tour. And she's saying things like, I don't even have time to eat a candy bar or get a cup of coffee. My life is, you know, amazing. And she would go, I don't even have time to get a coffee. But, you know, no, I don't even have time to get it's so fabulous. I love my life, you know. And so you're turning the wheel just a little bit like that, but it can make all the difference in a show and how people receive the production. When we were doing Clean Alternatives here, is when Rachel and I first started talking about positive choices. Brian Dykstra, who was the lead in that, and he, you know, a lot of it is political diatribe, and it was getting him to not grind down on it and to turn it. And he didn't understand what we were talking about when we were hitting him about the positive choice. And now he is using it constantly. He's doing a show, Laughing Liberally, in New York right now, and that's political comedy. And he just constantly goes back to doing the positive choice. How am I going to hug my audience? How am I going to not grind it down? And it's just putting what is the positive way of spinning that, and that's just a little directing tool that can really help an actor.
I want to ask you this too, because you talked about private lives, and I know you've done the Glass Menagerie and stuff. How do you get a new take on shows that you've been seeing since high school, and get the productions that you've seen so many times out of your head and give it a new take? Is it possible?
Wow, I have to say, Private Lives, I studied everything I could get my hands on. I went back and watched clips of the Rickman Broadway production on YouTube. I went and watched, and I just flooded my brain with all of that, because part of your knowledge is that the audience coming into the room is going to have seen productions of it. But I found that I didn't have to get it out of my head. I had to get it in my head, because it made me understand how many different interpretations of that there could be. Frankly, this is terrible. I mean, I loved Alan Rickman, loved him, but I had problems with the Broadway production. I thought there were some things that didn't work in the second act, and I think I know how to do this better, and that's the hubris of direction, right? So if you don't feel that way, you probably shouldn't be directing the piece, but I don't really think it's about getting it out of your head. Would you say you directed Glass Menagerie?
Right, yeah, I directed Glass Menagerie and The Price, and Virginia Woolf. And The Delicate Balance. I mean, these are plays
that we've all seen.
I think once you get into the room with the actors, it becomes something else. Because it is, again, it's that group of people putting on this play with this production in this theater at that time, and everything is a new mix. I saw The Price when I was, I don't know, 21 years old in New York, and I remember walking outside, standing on the street, and saying, if I ever could create something that's as moving as I feel at this moment in time, you know, I will have completed my life as an artist. And so when I started to direct the play, I was so sure that I understood the play until we started doing it. And I actually thought that one of those brothers was more equal than the other. Imagine that, how terrible that was.
This is an Arthur Miller play, isn't it?
Yeah. And when we started sitting at the table, and I suddenly realized that Walter, who I thought was always the bad guy, well, he had some really good things that he had done, and Victor wasn't the true hero of the piece. And by the time we finished with it, I now have no memory of that of that other production of it. Mm-hmm. And it was one of my favorite plays to direct at the at the Kitchen. I just think when you get in the when you have those wonderful words of those kinds of guys, you know, like if you're in an Arthur Miller play, or especially if you're in an Edward Albee world, you know, and it improves everything. You know, you walk around all day long talking better language. Leslie has things she wants to bring us.
Okay, that would be great. All right, let's do a few questions. Do you have to sit down reading with the actor before you start rehearsing?
Oh, well, are you talking about process? I mean, what you do the first day of rehearsal is you sit around a table and you read the play out loud together. But I don't know if that answers the question. When you're casting, you have them read their part.
Mm-hmm. You just sit around a table and read it first, right?
Yeah. First day of rehearsal.
When you're first casting somebody, So do you have anything to add to
that? No, you said it's called the table read, and everybody sits down.
It's the most exciting day.
Yes, it's really so great. all your hopes for everything are riding that day. And sometimes the table read is so good, you don't get back to as good a go-through of the play for two more weeks. I mean, it's just amazing. People are sitting there, and they're just, it's so really exciting, and then we get in there, mess it up, and it takes them 2 weeks to get back to where they were that first day.
It's about first impulses.
Right. It's just people are just boom like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, this is for Rachel. From the last 5 years, what is your favorite Kitchen production?
Oh, come on. There is none. There is none.
All of my children.
Yes, right. I love all my children.
She loves
all
of them.
I can't tell you. I love them all.
I want to start a dialogue. We'll ask another question, but I want to ask you both if you think theater will continue to be a dynamic and powerful force in this culture that's changing so quickly. And we were talking earlier about people wanting just individual entertainment. And are we going to still have a vibrant theater world in the next few years? Do you have any thoughts about the way entertainment is moving?
Well, if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I think there's nothing that can replace the experience of something that happens in front of a group of people in a mm-hmm. community setting with live people. I mean, you're sitting at home with your TV. It's just not, it's not the same. And having that living, breathing person on stage telling a story in front of you just goes back to the beginning of time when we've had it throughout our history. I just feel like it can and it will evolve, just like we were talking about radio. Radio is evolving, and mm-hmm. with podcasts, and the theater will naturally evolve. And a lot of people in the theater right now are exploring bringing media in, and so it's naturally going to. But I just, obviously, I believe in it. I think the mm-hmm. trick is inspiring young people to come to the theater and to do things that are relevant to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about you, Rachel?
Well, and of course, I have to hope that the live theater is going to be continuing, because I agree with Margaret. There's nothing like going to a live theater production. I think that everyone is trying to figure out how do you deal with new media and incorporate it in plays. There was something I was reading in American Theater Magazine where they were actually having people tweet during the show, just the opposite of what we say, like, you know, please don't text during the show. Uh-huh. There was actual texting happening and including the audience in the texting process. So I just think there's going to have to be a lot of creativity thinking about it, and how many young people, when they come to the theater, they get hooked. Mm. It's getting them there the first time that's really can be really difficult, particularly if it's not like the High School Musical where their, you know, their friends are all in it. Mm. But I think, you know, we're seeing texting in shows, we're seeing a lot of projections, we're seeing the use of, I mean, certainly on Broadway you see the use of technology.
Mm-hmm. So it is almost melding with performance art, some straight theater, or are they totally separate?
Well, performance art is a completely different genre. Mm-hmm. But certainly there is opportunity to use anything. I mean, I think there used to be a period of time when there was a straight play was this kind of event, and a musical was this kind of event. And now that's performance art was over here, and, you know, people who did storytelling were over there. I think all of that is interweaved in the same way there isn't modern dance and ballet anymore. You know, there's you can play Beethoven, and you can also play some brand new music by Steve Stuckey. You know, I mean, it's not
exactly. You know. And here's another question: knowing the community, how can it be more accessible to low-income people? What do you think about that? Not just for intellectuals.
Hmm.
I mean, the price of a Broadway ticket, for instance, is beyond a lot of people's being able to afford it.
Well, I think all the theaters in Ithaca offer people the opportunity to usher. And so that is a way to come and see the play and not have to pay anything. Mm-hmm. The truth is that it costs quite a lot to put on a play. It costs a lot to put on a play that's a professional level mm-hmm. play, and mm-hmm. all the theaters in Ithaca are trying to be as artistically excellent as possible. So there's always going to be a cost for it. But anyone who wants to come and see the theater can come and see the theater, and can come and see the theater for free. And there are lots of options for it. I think what we've done, particularly this year at the Kitchen, we've been building to it for the last 5 or 6 years, is that we've programmed pieces that appeal to a wide diversity of experience. And so now that we're in a new neighborhood, we're really enjoying not just our wonderful, dedicated subscribers who have been supporters for years and years and years, but a lot of new people, new faces are coming in. And I don't think we do plays that are too intellectual for anybody. Mm. I think everybody has a place where they meet a play, and they meet that play with their own life experience. And we put on plays that require engagement. So we say, you know, bold, intimate, engaging. We try to engage the audience. And I don't think we ever do it. I don't feel, I mean, I'd be interested to hear that we would do a play that would be, that's too intellectual for me. Mm-hmm. Nobody's walked in this theater, whether they're 5 years old or whatever, and not been engaged in what it is. So I think, and as far as the income thing goes, I mean, you can come and usher, and there are people who just come and say, I can't afford to come. What can I do? You figure it out. We figure out how that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have anything to add to that, Margaret?
Accessibility. There are programs, and I can only speak to New York, and most of the Broadway shows now are doing student rush, and they will set out the first two rows. A lot of them do this, and you can wait, and you have to wait in line. But you can usually, for about $25, I think it is, see something, and that's still a lot of money, but there are things. And a lot of ushering opportunities. A lot of the off-Broadway theaters, I know Soho Rep is doing it, and I know 1589 is doing it, like $10, $15 rush or pay what you can nights.
Oh.
I think the theater community is so aware of trying to get young people and people that don't normally go to the theater to come in and try it. So we are making efforts. It's just, it is expensive to put it on, so there's so much you can do, you know.
Are there any plays that you guys would be afraid to direct? Have you been offered anything that you just said, no way am I going to touch that?
Yes.
What?
6 characters in Search of an Author.
Really?
Although I would do it. And I wouldn't do it, but I would do it, but it would have to be under exactly the right circumstances. I saw Robert Brustein's production at ART, and it was one of the best things I've ever seen, and I can't imagine it being done any better.
Ah.
So
I was thinking you were afraid of the material.
And now I would add Our Town to that list because of the Barrow Street production that was it just went, well, how could that be done any better? You know, so that, you know, my take's not going to be better than that, so why would I bother? But over the years, because this was maybe 30 years ago that I saw 6 characters, and I am a huge fan of deconstructed theater and meta theater, so I think I would now, if I had just the right cast and just the right tech support, I might go after it.
I might dare. What about you, Rachel?
There are lots of plays that I know that I'm glad I'm the artistic director because I can hire the right director for them.
Ah. Yeah.
But did you say afraid to direct?
Afraid to direct.
I don't think I'm afraid to direct. I just know that there are people who I would want to see their production of it. It would take me a lot of work to do certain things that, you know, unless it like suddenly interested me, I want to figure out how to do this kind of a play. I remember my first year here, we did Paula Vogel's Desdemona, a play about a handkerchief that Norm Johnson had scheduled. And I felt like I had to direct it because I so did not understand the play. I didn't know how I could artistic direct somebody else directing the play. And I think we did a production that a lot of people really enjoyed. I'm still not sure that I understand that play, but I figured out something that we did.
I have to say that when Rachel offered me my first job after Clean Alternatives, it was a play called A Marriage Minuet.
Ah.
And
no, you're absolutely wrong. I offered you another play that you said no to.
But I had another job.
No, I don't think that
yes,
was
I
the
can tell this is, this is an old...
When you were doing After Ashley, when
yeah,
I did you ask?
I didn't.
Really?
I had another job. I was producing an off-Broadway show.
Yeah, well, somebody you know very well says it tells another story, but we'll have to be something else. We won't say.
Okay, he's the old married couple.
Okay, there maybe was a teeny bit of not wanting to come back and be a disappointment.
Just ding!
But I was making a ton of money as a producer in this thing, and I thought I really
should. Ton of money, there you go.
You know. But when I got Marriage Minuet, which, you know, after Ashley, I feel like I could direct, like, that show.
That's what I thought, too.
Up my alley.
But you
Marriage
said no.
Minuet was supposed to be...
It was one of those plays that you read and you say, if people do not laugh, this is a failure.
Uh-huh.
You trick yourself in the theater all the time to watch a show that you've directed in. Well, they were quiet. They were listening. But when it's a comedy, and it's a comedy, and that's all it is, really,
yeah.
I mean, not all, but,
uh-huh.
and they're not laughing, you know you're a failure. So, this would be the first out-and-out comedy that I'd ever directed, other than a really bad production of A Greater Tuna that I had done about 15 years ago.
I'd
which
forgotten
not a lot
about
of people
that
laughed.
Play, yeah.
Yeah, I directed the dark version.
The dark version of Greater Tuna.
Greater Tuna, a tragedy.
My husband turned to me and said, how did you turn Greater Tuna dark? I don't know, it's my magic. I learned
it was
my
an
life.
Environmental study, the tuna.
But that show, Marriage Minuet, I was terrified that it wasn't going to be funny, and sat down for the first table read with Matt Boston saying the first words of the play, and we all started laughing immediately and never stopped, and that is still one of the most fun times I have ever had directing. And I used to peek in the old kitchen theater door, just watch a couple of the scenes that just would make me scream with laughter, and as I remember, the audiences really liked it. I think it sold very well. Did
very well.
It was one of the funny plays.
It
got me over my funny fear.
Right. I've hired you to do many comedies since.
And now I do funny all the time.
Well, I can't help but notice that a lot of your plays refer to food. The soup comes last. Bed,
I'm
no
glad
breakfast,
it's
comfort
radio.
Food.
I'm
are you
Let's picture Paul Proudhon as an artistic director.
But it feels like you're a frustrated food host or something with all these titles. It's fascinating.
I do a lot of entertaining in my house.
Ah.
And I feel like some of the best theatrical moments have happened in my while I'm cooking or while I'm talking to somebody while I'm cooking or while I'm serving food. And
theater is called the kitchen.
It is called the kitchen theater. Although I think I lucked into that. I mean, I didn't name it. But no, I do. I think you know, food for the body, food for the soul, food for
the creative mind.
The a lot of things happen around food. You know, I mean, what is this? Food, sex, death. What are the important things that we have to write about?
I guess birth would be important.
And love. And love. I mean, you know, like when you take a little writing course, that's like, you know, those are the four things they say you can write about, you know. So.
Well, we are almost out of time. I want to ask you just one last question. What are you working on now? And anything new coming out in the next few months?
Oh, well, I'm about to direct Mary's Wedding. I didn't direct all year, and I'm actually directing the last two, Mary's Wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And the play that we're doing at the end of the season, which is called At a Loss, which is going to be a world premiere. It's a wonderful, funny comedy. I'm so glad to be doing a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working on a musical with Larry Presgrove that we're going to do next season here that I'm really excited about, if I don't get writer's block.
Are we going to be graced by your directing here at the kitchen anytime soon?
Yeah, I'll be back next season. We don't know what plays we'll be doing yet, but I intend to be back. And the next play that I'm working on is called God of Carnage, which was on Broadway a couple of years ago. I'm doing it at the Human Race in Dayton. And it looks like I'm going to be directing my first feature film. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to stay tuned for that. That
yeah.
sounds great. Margaret Perry, Rachel Lampert, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega.
and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.